In the final piece for today, I caught up with Don Sutherland to get his take on the reports at the end of 2022 of an historic low in union membership.
In mid-December last year, the Australian Bureau of Statistics produced its latest data on union membership. And that data showed a continuing decline, so that at the present time, union membership, total union membership is at 12.5%. For full-time workers, it's a bit higher at 13.3%, which means obviously part-time workers is about 10.8%. Now, this is pretty dreadful. And the fact that it deteriorated over the last 2 years is consistent with the longer term pattern. When the ABS released the data, it traced the pattern back to 1992. In fact, it was well established before that. There is some data that shows that the decline in union density started in 1978 when the Fraser government introduced its anti-solidarity laws, sections 45D and E of the Trades Practices Act, that made illegal workers acting in solidarity with each other across work sites and across industries. So it's a longer term trend, and the current generation of union leadership are proving to be as incapable of all the previous ones to work out what needs to be done about it. That's, in a sense, the crisis has two dimensions. There's the raw numbers, and then really there's the lack of vision that is required to work out just what it is that will begin to turn the situation around.
Because there's a common belief that with the reduction or the change in the industrial landscape away from major industrial work sites, that that was the beginning of the end of large membership numbers. Is that a contributing factor, the fact that our work, the landscape has changed?
It may be a contributing factor. I think there's a number that interact with each other, and that may be one of them. You see, the rise in, when union density has risen, the big increases in the early part of the last century and so on, you know, most workplaces were small. And yet union density increased then. Now, of course, it is still a different landscape, so there is some sort of issue there, but there are others, and one of them is, of course, how, well, it's a subjective thing, I know, but one of them is indeed what strategy does a union leadership, those who are responsible for the health of the union movement from a leadership level, you know, what is their strategy? Although we saw some elements of a strategy between about 1988 and 1994, that has since started to fall apart and then fell apart, except for a brief period in the context of the struggle against Howard's workplace bargaining laws.
Yes. So what you're saying, I guess, would be that the people's consciousness of the value of collective action was enhanced by that attack.
Yes, not to the degree that would develop a permanent reversal of the decline, but certainly one that started to create the knowledge and awareness of what the possibilities might be. In my view, the most serious thing, and you can see the timeline association if you look closely, is that in the more recent period, it's the emergence of a non-combative strategy. This year is the anniversary of the Accord, of course, in 1983. So it's going to be a lot more discussion about this in the ranks of progressive and socialist organisations, and broader than that, one would hope, including right through the union movement. But the I think there is slowly the small C communist and capital C communist influence in our union movement, which was never a dominant influence. It was influential to a degree that was significant, but never dominant. But to the degree that it existed, that coincides with a combative part of the union movement that would generate major campaigns. And some of them would then be translated into gains for the whole of the working class. And that has been lost. And that loss, so it's associated with the disappearance almost of a small C communist, capital C communist, because there was a Communist Party of Australia and so on, and a lot of their people were active at all levels of the union movement and very influential in their own way. And then there are others who were of a small C, that is not in the CPA or anything like that. And they created this combativeness, this willingness to stand up against the employers.
Yep.
And pursue a sort of what was called in the 1970s and 80s a mindful militancy that would have big impacts. There was always debate about this. It wasn't by all means easy. But persuading those workers who had more bargaining power and were on higher wages to accept that they should adapt their strategy to ensure that there were effective flow-ons to those workers who are on the lower award rates and so on. It was called a wages of solidarity strategy. It was pursued both in a mindfully militant way, starting in workplaces and industries, but then it was also built into what was required and forced into the movement by the requirements of conciliation and arbitration in the Conciliation and Arbitration Commission.
But what strikes me is that what you're talking about is the effect of culture, a cultural shift.
Yeah, I think that's one way of putting it. Yes, yes. You see, the combative mentality, it's almost like, well, a good example today is in today's Financial Review, we have the National Secretary of the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union, Steve Murphy, who was one of the more visionary thinkers. There's the few are still there. He's running the argument about the proposal that surfaced after these horrible numbers came out in mid-December to introduce statutory bargaining fees so that unions would get, and union members would get, some benefit out of bargaining that the results of which would flow on to non-members. So it was all about bargaining fees. But it's written in the Financial Review, and it's written addressed to employers, and it's asking employers to be more cooperative, to cooperate more with the union movement and accept this proposal. All right, so there's. It's almost as though we're apologising. We're apologising for pursuing an agenda. And there is no combativeness in that.
No.
You know, we turn from asking the Labor Party to solve problems for the working class to asking the employers to help solve a problem by being agreeable to the introduction of bargaining fees. Yet the employers have got us where they're very happy with where they've got us at the moment.
Yeah, I'm sure they are.
12% union density, they're delighted. They'd like it to go lower, of course, because they're never satisfied. So I fail to understand. See, bargaining fees may be a very good idea. Probably a good idea within the framework of the strategy. And there's nothing in this plea, this rather sad plea in some ways, for employers to be more cooperative. There's nothing there about a strategy. Now, that might not be such a bad idea that we don't advertise what the strategy might be, but and there may well be one being cranked up, but goodness me, you'd have to go looking with tweezers through the natural to find out where it might be.
Yeah, well, that leads me to look at the approach that was to have bigger unions, continually bigger unions, and what that means in terms of the landscape for a membership organisations such as the unions. Like what's going on with the United Workers Union that represents such a vast array of different types of workers?
Well, union amalgamations, in my view, are relative. They're not wrong in principle. But most Australian union amalgamations have been pursued in substitute for developing a strategy. So on this occasion, I mean, there's other unions talking amalgamation at the moment. So it's almost like this is why I really worry about the strategic thinking capacity at the moment. I would love to be proved wrong about this.
Yep.
But you see, as soon as you turn to a union amalgamation, There is no evidence that union amalgamations on their own reverse union density problem.
None. Well, clearly, obviously, it clearly hasn't.
And there's no
evidence
that bargaining fees are going to do it either. And, if I'm wrong about this, terrific. I'd like to be. But
well,
I don't
actually, logically speaking, Don, it doesn't make any sense to pander or go to the oppositional power and say, let me have a little bit of your power so that I can keep going. Unless you look at the old evidences that came out of places like Germany that showed that different workplaces succeeded in profit better when they negotiated using with union representation on their boards, etc. There's evidence of that, isn't there?
Well, there's contradictory evidence about all of that. And it's mixed up with other things as well, including the composition, the class composition of the German working class, in which there has been massive migration and really serious problems with huge wage differentials associated with that and so on. So I don't really... I think the thing we've got to do is focus on, what is feasible in the current situation.
The reason why I brought it up was, why would they think... Why would someone ask the employers to have a fee arrangement for negotiations? What's in it for the employer? Why would they do that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's why I worry that it just appears so sad. And it's just, I might say it's not like the usual Steve Murphy, so I just don't know what's going on there. But you see, the thing is, one of the worsening crises is in terms of inequality. And over the same period, we had the Oxfam report, which showed that country by country, as well as globally, how much inequality was getting worse, including in Australia.
Yep.
And we have a bigger and bigger proportion of the Australian working class whose standard of living is defined more and more by the annual wage review. Now, the annual wage review, of course, the rules around the annual wage review are broken, although... This year's annual wage review will be the first one in which closing the gender pay gap becomes a permissible issue to be addressed in the review process. So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. So we have a rising inequality. What's going on with low wage, those on the minimum wage and those on the lowest rates in the award system, is that there's bigger numbers of them. And also the number of workers who are on sort of de facto individual agreements in which they're paid a couple of dollars above the minimum rates just to keep them away from a union. That's the scene there. So the annual wage review is actually a very big deal. And yet the current strategy says pay lip service to that.
I suppose they're acting as if the low pay are not the majority.
Yeah, and my hunch is they're not being organised into unions. And is there a relationship between the two things, that we pay lip service in terms of our industrial effort, our union, our current union activist effort? We pay lip service to the annual wage review, and we're not attracting young people, and we're not attracting people who are on low incomes. So that's the first element of the current strategy. The second element is, of course, enterprise bargaining as the dominant method of seeking to get wage rates above the minimums. And what we know about that is two things. Firstly, it's not working because the gap between the lowest levels in awards and enterprise group agreement wages is narrower, even though union agreements are better than non-union agreements.
Yep.
And the second thing we know about that, apart from the fact that it's not working, is that it's not attracting new members. The third element is in terms of, trying to unite what's left of the union movement, is part what I call parliamentary unionism. The dominant mentality in our union movement is that the big problems that we face relative to the law, for example, can only be fixed through pleadings and negotiations and consultations with the Labor Party now that it's in government. In other words, get the Labor Party elected and then go into a negotiation, consultation process and get them to make what we hope will be better laws that will enable us then to go on and attract new members into the union movement. If anything, these latest union density numbers show that three-element strategy, parliamentary unionism, enterprise bargaining and lip service to the annual wage review, is not working.
You think that they're the nub of the problem and that's going to be the point where change will have to come from?
The reality is that's the strategy at the moment. Overall, that's what it's all about.
What do you think should
and
be the strategy?
What we know for sure is it's not tackling inequality, and secondly, it's not tackling the problem of union density.
No, it's not.
And union power is constricted without strong union density, without growing union density.
I mean, I know there's efforts to raise awareness using social media and other forms of media to tackle the lack of youthful awareness of what a union really is, for example.
Yes, and it's all bound up with, you know, a little bit of union education here and there, which is based on the Americanized so-called organizing model.
Yeah.
But there are serious problems with making that the sort of way in which you run a recruitment course to solve a decline in union density. Well, yes, you do need to do that. It's not in itself, especially applied discreetly, it's not in itself going to solve the problem. I've run courses like that, and you just know when you're talking to experienced organisers in those courses, they've worked that out. They know that from their own experience, that what they're learning about how to talk one-to-one with a non-union member is not in itself going to be a silver bullet. It's a bit like the other two silver bullets we talked about. You know, so there's little bits of the jigsaws that are all useful in their own way, but we like desperados, we grab hold of one here and another then, and we look at a next one for tomorrow and so on without working out. Yet the strategy that works is staring us in the face. And that is running a campaign that actually addresses one of the most serious problems facing especially younger workers, and that's low incomes and insecure jobs.
Yeah, that's right.
And so the incomes problem starts with defying the broken rules of the annual wage review and reapplying the good tactics and skills and tools associated with online organising used in parliamentary unionism and reapplying it into a mass education process associated with the annual wage review that reaches into the hearts and minds of younger workers. And that means that more experienced workers who have been around unions for a while will latch onto that, and they will be a lot more helpful and effective in what they can contribute to rebuild our union movement. We can't go on with the current strategy. Those three big elements to it are a failure, and they need to be replaced by something that is more combative. How you get more combativeness without small c communist influence is a moot point. There are so many other problems. Union credibility around other issues, which are essential for unions to really be making a contribute to. The climate crisis and the threat to the planet, for example, that is a very big deal. And some of the things that unions in Australia have been doing are really terrific. But the reach and strength and impact of those union efforts are constrained by where union density is at the present time. We could go also to the struggle over against racism in the context of what's going on with The Voice at the moment. Unions have a proud history. We've also got a ratty history in some areas as well. The left of the union movement in particular has got a proud history in fighting racism, acting in solidarity with our Aboriginal peoples. It's going to be important in the context of the Voice debate that's going to go on this year as well. But union density being so low leaves us vulnerable to be rendered marginal. That's really the big strategic question our union movement has to face. the bigger the annual wage review increase, then the better is the flow-on effect for the age pension and I think also the disabled pension. But it's a big deal about the equality issue as it impacts upon the whole of the working class.
Yeah, and the whole fabric of society.
The only thing I would add perhaps to finish off is that mixed up in all this, of course, is that the employers are onto a lot of this. I mean, they are really building up to be extremely difficult on a number of fronts. And you've already got the Reserve Bank governor swinging behind them to support a wage cut at the annual wage review.
Unbelievable.
That's already happening. That's what the Australian Industry Group and the other employer organisations will be looking for. We can either just do the same old, or we adopt a totally different approach. That's where we need to go. We need to go to a totally different approach, knowing that the employers are going for our throats, because they are.